You're listening to Thursday Night Tailgate, where NFL legends live on, with Chris Mascaro and Bob Lasseri. Available on TuneIn and Podbean. Now, back to Chris and Bob.
Just listen.
All right, now back with us on the Kyven Foods guest line is former Seattle Seahawks linebacker Michael Jackson. Let me give you some background on Michael. He's from Pasco, Washington, which is in the southern part of the state, not far from the Oregon border. He stayed home and played his college ball at the University of Washington, where he was a four-year letterman and named to their all-centennial football team. He was named the Empire Amateur Athlete of the Year in 1977, the same year he helped lead the Huskies to a victory in the Rose Bowl. His last-second interception in the end zone saved the game against Michigan. He was a third-round draft pick by the Seattle Seahawks in 1979, and he played in the league from 79 to 1986, all in Seattle. And we're excited to have Michael back with us tonight here on Thursday Night Tailgate. Hey, Michael, Chris and Bob here. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, how are you?
Fantastic. Michael, how are you?
Doing very well, thank you.
So, Michael, I wanted to start our time with you tonight by going back to your time at the University of Washington. And, you know, when you were there, you were teammates with a guy who's been on our show many times, Warren Moon. So I'm curious to get your memories of playing with Warren, plus what it was like to defend against him every day at practice.
Defending against him, I'll start with that. It was very easy because we knew what he could do. We knew what he was capable of. I think he was more of a surprise to the opponents that we played than to those folks like the defense that we had that had to defend him every day. There were great times. We were very competitive. He was competitive. Our defense was. We wanted to beat him. He wanted to beat us. We felt like those years back from 75 through 78, the Rose Bowl years, were great years. And I think it launched us into the careers that we had in the pros.
And Michael, when you guys won the Rose Bowl back in 77, it was the first time Washington had played in the Rose Bowl or any kind of bowl since 1963, and the first time Washington would go on to win since 1960. What was it like for you guys? I'm curious, when you guys got back to campus following the Rose Bowl victory, right, with the Rose Bowl trophy in tow, what was it like for you guys back on campus?
It was crazy. It was every kid's dream. This is what you dream about when you're 5, 6, 7, 8 years old. Everybody wants to win that big game. They want the crowd to be there. They want the parades. They want to be admired. And certainly that's what we were. When we got back the night after the Rose Bowl, we landed at SeaTac Airport, and then we came to Husky, to the stadium, and we marched through the stadium there and through the Heck Edmondson Pavilion. People were lined up forever, it seemed like, for us, and just cheering us. And it was pure love. It's like I said, it's every kid's dream. That's what you play the game for, is to have those kind of victory parades.
And Michael, you know, just to get into that Rose Bowl, you had lost to UCLA earlier in the season, and you got into the Rose Bowl thanks to a last second win by USC over UCLA. Were you guys watching that game, rooting for USC, to get you in? Did you know that, boy, if USC could win this game, we can get into the Rose Bowl and then we can do some real damage? Were you guys big USC fans for a few hours that night?
We were huge USC fans at that time. I think everybody was at home at that time because we had finished our season. They had a game after we played Wazoo for our final game. We were very suspicious because California had always gone to the Rose Bowl, USC or UCLA had gone, and we kind of felt like USC would throw the game so that UCLA could win and keep us out of the Rose Bowl. But thankfully, they manned up and they came up and won the game for us. And I remember all the pictures that every media outlet in Seattle area was at Don James's house watching he and his family celebrate that victory. I happened to be over in the Tri-Cities with my family, and I saw it. And just, when the field goal went through, it was, you gotta be kidding me. We're going to the Rose Bowl. This is what we came to. This is why we played in the Pac-8 at that time. That's why I came to a Pac-8 team, is to play in the Rose Bowl. So it was huge for us.
Bob, questions for Michael?
Welcome back to the show, Michael. I wanted to ask you, when you left the University of Washington, when you're going into the pros, Michael, it's a It's a whole different ball game up there. As you, there was probably guys saying, you need to work on this. You got to get better at this. Personally, what did you think you needed to improve when you left Washington in order to succeed at the pro level?
Bob, to be honest with you, I didn't think I had to improve on anything because I played in the Pac-8. And we believed at that time that it was the best conference. We had the best athletes. We were better prepared for running the ball, passing the ball. We were better prepared for defending against the run and defending against the pass because we did both of them very well. Everybody in the Pac-8 at that time threw the ball and ran the ball very well. Maybe we weren't as physical as the Big Ten or the SEC at that time, but we did everything well. So when I got drafted by the Seahawks, I went to camp. I went to the rookie camp first, obviously, and I knew I could defend any pass attempt that you if you put me on a wide receiver, I could defend him because I was fast enough to do that. If you had a running back run a pass pattern on me, I knew that I could defend him because I was better than he was. Don James did such a great job of preparing everybody who played for him to be a pro athlete after they left the University of Washington, if that was their goal. And for me, that was my goal. So I paid strict attention to everything he and the coaching staff taught us. So when I got to the Seahawks in 79, it took me 3 games to win a starting position. So I think I came out of college, and I know that a lot of the guys that I played with believe the same thing, that we were very well prepared. We were more prepared than any other conference and their players coming out of college.
And I'm sure that was much appreciated by guys like Larry Pecatello. I did a little research this week, Michael, about your defensive coordinator. And a lot of people, if you mention Larry Pecatello's name, they'll probably say, I've never heard of the guy. Well, he was a defensive coordinator in the league for 20 years. You had him your first 2 in Seattle. Your opinion of him and the rest of the staff back then?
Well, Pecatello set me up for success. Like you said, he had a couple of linebackers who were in front of me when I was drafted, and he saw my potential and realized that I was going to be something of a star, maybe not an all-star, but something of a star, somebody who could contribute to the team and help the Seahawks win more games. And like I said, after the 3rd game of my first season, my rookie year, I was a starter, and the rest is history after that. Pecatello has a place in my heart forever. There's no doubt about that.
And Michael, just to finish up on your time with Washington in that Rose Bowl, you actually, like I mentioned in your intro, you sealed the victory in that Rose Bowl with an interception in the end zone. Take us through what you remember about that play.
I remember everything about that play. First of all, the interception happened on the 3-yard line. So we were ahead of Michigan throughout the first half. We were up 21-3 or something like that. And then they started, the physicalness of that team started beating us down. Our offense went a little bit flat in the second half, so the defense had to stop everything that Michigan was throwing at us, and they were throwing everything except the kitchen sink at us. So they're coming down the field. They're just running up and down the field on us. Finally, we get to the inside the 2-minute side, and they break off a big play and get down to around our 12-yard line. And Rick Leach is rolling out to my side, which was the left side on this play. He was going to throw the ball to Stanley Edwards. And we knew that we wanted Rick Leach to throw the ball and not run it. So my duty was to cover Stanley Edwards on the left flank. And then if Rick Leach started to run, I was going to break off the coverage and then attack Rick Leach. I was able to hold off making a decision as to whether to rush him or stay on Stanley Edwards. And I stayed back long enough. So he threw the ball to Stanley, who was open for a moment. The ball bounced off his hands and went to the top of his helmet. And I've seen the film many times since I graduated, and I was fully launched at him. My whole aim was to break up that pass. And when I got near him, I saw that he had lost control of the ball. It was on top of his helmet. So I reached up and grabbed it with my left hand and came down with the interception. My only thought was, did the referee see me catch this ball? Because I knew there was a referee to my left. And when I rolled over, I see this referee start standing and pointing back towards the other end zone. And he's like, this kid caught the ball. And he was my, I don't know who he was, but I'd kiss him on the lips right now if I could, because he saw me catch the ball and it was on the 3-yard line. And there was, from there, I remember taking this victory stroll up the left sideline where Michigan was, and my teammates are grabbing me on my jersey, trying to tackle me. And I'm trying to stay upright because I want to show Michigan that I did indeed catch this ball. And this game is now over. We have won this game. It was, I tell you, I've never worked so hard to get off the field in that moment because everybody on our team wanted to congratulate me. And it was just pure heaven.
So, Michael, you get drafted by the Seahawks in 79. It was only their third year in existence. For those who don't remember, the Seahawks came in the league in 76. Was it a dream come true for you to be able to play your whole career, if you will, in the state of Washington? Or, based on how new the Seahawks were and the struggles that they had over the first couple of seasons, were you hoping maybe someone else had taken you?
Well, prior to the draft, I had been told by all the draft analysis that I would be drafted in the second round by the Houston Oilers at that time. And then when the Oilers got their second round draft pick, they drafted another linebacker, Darrell Hunt. I believe he played at Oklahoma. And I was really disappointed. So at that time, I turned the radio off and I walked outside of my apartment and I was really despondent because I thought the draft analysts knew everything and everything was going to be all right for me. Then later on, the Oilers drafted late in the second round. And then, the Seahawks drafted Joe Norman, late in the second round as well. And then, the Seahawks had the first draft in the third round, which was number 51. I didn't hear my name called. I got a call from Jack Patera, who was the coach at that time for the Seahawks. And to be honest with you, and I've told Joe this and I've apologized to him, I thought Jack was calling to apologize for not drafting me. But he says, congratulations, we've drafted you with the first round or the first draft in the third round, number 51. You're going to be a Seahawk. And I said, what the hell? So I lived east of Seattle at that time across Lake Washington, and the sports reporters said, And the report the next day that they could see me flying or walking across the water. I was so happy. And I was elated to be drafted by the Seahawks because I never even dreamed about playing for the Seahawks. I wanted to play for the Oilers because that's who said they were going to draft me. And so it was a little bit of a disappointment. But then when you realize that, dude, you don't have to move. You can stay in the same apartment. You can buy a house here in Seattle. You can live your life here in the area, the state that you grew up. Nothing gets better than that. And then to realize that Husky fans are also Seahawk fans, so I'm going to have a built-in house for people rooting for me. It was like, idiot, get over it. Go be a Seahawk.
Michael, one last one before we let you go. And last time we had you on the show, you had raised some concerns about the 83 AFC Championship game that you guys played against the Raiders and the thought or some of the decisions made by the coaching staff, with some of the play calls and the calls on defense and that sort of thing. Do those concerns still exist? Are you still concerned that maybe the coaching staff didn't put you guys in the right spot or may have made some decisions that cost you guys the opportunity to win that game?
I don't have any concerns about that. I know for a fact that they threw the game. The coaching staff threw that game. There's no way the Raiders should have beat us. It's still emotional to me. There's no flipping way that the Raiders were a better team than we were that day, that year, that century. We were a much better team. We were better prepared. We were ready to come out and whoop some ass that day, and they didn't let us do it. They pulled back the reins on us. If a guy, John Harris, who was our weak safety, he was the signal caller for making the audibles. He was told not to change any more plays throughout the rest of that game. We threw that game, and till my dying day, I will preach that from the highest mountain.
Wow. So has anything ever become of that? I know you talked to us about that several years ago. You still have that concern. Has anything ever been said to the coaching staff? Has anyone ever addressed that, that notion for what happened that day?
That coaching staff obviously never doesn't exist anymore with the Seahawks. They've moved on to a better coaching staff, one that believes that winning is important. The coaching staff that we had, unfortunately, believed that maybe they got paid off. I don't know what happened to them or what happened with them, but they never let us exude our dominance over the Raiders that day. So it's not a concern that I have. It's a fact that I have. I know that we were better athletes than the Raiders that day. And if no, maybe that's one of the reasons that I don't really care about professional football anymore, is because apparently it can be bought. The victories can be bought. The gratitude can be bought. Everything that comes with winning can be bought. You have to remember that in 1983, the Seahawks were they were only 7 years old. We were 7 years old. The Raiders have been around since the old AFL, the American Football League, when they were separate from the NFL. So they were a more viable product. They're from Hollywood. And so everybody thought that would be a better match, that the advertising dollars would be there. And, you know, advertising buys everything nowadays. So they bought them off. They paid them, but they didn't play us. They didn't pay us. We have one chance, a professional athlete, if you get one chance to win a world championship, that's the chance that you take. You'll put everything on, you'll put the CTEs on the line. You'll go through the pain that I'm going through, that every other athlete's going through, to win a championship, because you can say, I was world champion. I was the best, not one of the best. I was the best that year. I proved myself. Me and my team proved this. We should have been allowed to do that. And our coaching staff under Coach Knox didn't allow us to do that. And forever, I will be resentful for that fact.
Wow. It's an amazing thing. You know, you got to wonder what you know, how it all went down and those sorts of things. I know you were passionate about it a few years ago when you talked to us, and I can, you know, definitely tell it's still weighing heavily on you. So it's an amazing story, and hopefully we can find more details about that sort of thing. Hopefully the truth comes out one day, Michael. I know you want that, and I'd love to hear it.
I'd love to hear the truth, too, because I know the truth. The truth is they made us lay down. They were suckers. They were punks. They didn't allow us to win that game. We should have won. We could have won that game blindfolded.
Amazing. Michael, before we let you go, how can our listeners stay up to date with what you're doing now and follow you, whether it's online or over social media?
I was asked that question the other day, and I'm on Twitter, but I don't tweet a lot because I have more sense than most people who tweet. I think I'm Husky Legend 5MJ or something like that. And then on Facebook, Michael Anthony Jackson, you can find me there. I work for Nexus Youth and Families, and you can follow us there, nexusforkids.org, Nexus 4, the number 4, kids, plural, .org. That's where I work. I'm the development director there. I'm raising money for an organization that helps kids who are homeless, age 13 through 25. We do mental health therapy and drug and alcohol treatment for kids birth through age 25. And I find a lot of satisfaction doing that. That's what gets me up every morning, is giving back to my community.
That's great stuff, Michael. Michael, it's been great having you back on the show. It was far too long since the last visit. We hope you'll come back again, you know, sooner this time, and share more of your memories and your insights with you, because you're fantastic.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much. You guys give us a great opportunity. I really appreciate your show.
Thank you, Mike. All the best to you and your family, my friend. We'll catch up soon.
Sounds good.
That is Michael Jackson. And again, you know, he was instrumental back in the, you know, the early part of the late 70s and the early part of the Seahawks, you know, organization and their existence. So, Bob, a great player at the University of Washington. Certainly, they wouldn't have won that Rose Bowl without him. And then, you know, it's very interesting, the notion for what might have happened in that AFC Championship game.
Yeah, it's a very unique take on things. You know, you would think a guy that spent his whole career in one city, Chris, would leave with terrific memories. And I'm sure most of them are good, but it's a tough thing to stomach, and you can see it's still bothering him.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, that's a story I'd love to learn the truth about.
There's all this talk that women are breaking through in electronic music. It's ludicrous.
We've been here the whole time. Yet last year, only 17% of music festival headliners were women. We need to reclaim electronic music and put women back in the story. Help us double the number of women headliners in electronic music. Get involved at Smirnoff.com. Smirnoff. Equalizing Music.